You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the opening pages of Amy Bloom's latest novel, Lucky Us, Eva Logan, her 12-year-old protagonist, is abruptly abandoned by her mother at the upscale home her father shares with his other family in a wealthy Ohio town. There, for the first time, Eva meets her beautiful and talented half-sister, Iris, who tells Eva she plans to run off to Hollywood and become a movie star. When Iris sneaks out of the house with a suitcase late one night, Eva goes with her, and their adventure begins. The novel's getting wonderful reviews. The Christian Science Monitor called it the biggest novel of the summer. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Amy Bloom back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Throughout her childhood, Eva has seen her father on Sundays and Thursdays when he eats dinner with her and her mother at the small house they share, but he's away the rest of the week. Now, there's a lovely sweetness and innocence to Eva. Is that why she's never questioned her parents' living arrangements?
Well, I think that often when you're a kid, what you know is what you know. And if this is how your family is, this is how your family is. I mean, certainly when I was growing up, I remember I had a girlfriend who came over to our house probably when she was about 12 or something and left, and she said, "Your dad's not lying on the couch." I said, "No." And she said, "Oh."
Well, you learned a lot about her family, obviously. But is part of the reason she can seem so innocent is that your story takes place between 1939 and 1949, when children had much less information about the world outside their homes? A character like Eva in a book today might seem hopelessly naive.
I think a character like Eva in a book that was set in the present would seem peculiar. And one of the things that I sometimes observe when people are writing stories with young characters is they wish to preserve that innocence, but it's really a struggle when you have the videos and the TV and all of this barrage of images and sounds and stories, whether or not they are really well suited for young people.
And you tell the story in the first person from Eva's perspective. Now, some writers resist doing that because when you're writing from a young person's perspective, there are certain things that you can't know.
I love the fact that there are things you can't know. It's one of my favorite things in a narrative. There's a moment in Wings of the Dove where Henry James has taken us in the boat ride across the water, then you walk across the palazzo, then you go up the stairs, and you're about to overhear the conversation, and he says, "There are some conversations one is not in time to hear."
But you do give us a lot of information that Eva wouldn't have had access to by including letters that were written to Eva by Iris and others.
Absolutely. I grew up reading a lot of 19th century fiction, and I love the epistolary approach. I don't want it all the time because I want to be able to see things in different ways and be present in the moment in different occasions, but the chance for me to use the letters, to use the notes, was just wonderful.
To give different perspectives.
Yeah.
But then you also have to come up with other voices.
You do, and that, since that seems to me the heart of my job, I only have two jobs. One is to come up with the characters, and the other one is to tell the story.
In her rave review in the New York Times on July 20th, Janet Maslin suggested that the opening lines of your book are destined to be quoted in many a classroom for their perfection. Would you read a little bit from the start?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
I'm sorry I didn't prepare you for this.
That's okay. this chapter is called "I'd Know You Anywhere." My father's wife died. My mother said we should drive down to his place and see what might be in it for us. She tapped my nose with her grapefruit spoon. "It's like this," she said. "Your father loves us more, but he's got another family, a wife, and a girl a little older than you. Her family had all the money. Wipe your face."
We'll let readers go on from there, but I think that's a wonderful tease. This is your first novel in 7 years. The last time you were here in 2010, we talked about your short story collection, Where the God of Love Hangs Out. And you've published a lot of short stories. Do you think of yourself as a short story writer first?
I really think of myself at this point as a writer. I think a good sentence is a good sentence is a good sentence.
But when you sat down to write this and you came up with that, those very good sentences, did you have a sense that that was the beginning of a novel? Did you sit down to write a novel?
Oh, alas, I did think it was a novel. I mean, that's always sort of bad news in my household. But yeah, I thought, oh, I see this. I see, you know, it's like being the fake psychic. I see a journey. I see these two sisters. I see the war. And I thought, oh, I bet that's going to be a novel.
And then you have a lot of other characters. Do they all come along as you're writing it?
They do come along. And
the surprises as well?
Yes. I mean, one hopes for that. I mean, I do. I like incident. I like things that happen. I like giving my characters an opportunity to reveal other parts of their personality. You know, I like for the cold-hearted con man to reveal his warmth. I like for the good girl to show the depth of her cunning. I like giving people opportunities.
You also have a situation here where Eve is not going to school.
She isn't. I suspect that this reflects not only the reality of that period in which some people went to school and finished their education and many people did not, but also my own feelings about my own education, which was that it was not at all clear to me that anything was served by the period between like 9th grade and 12th grade. And so I think I wanted to give Eva an opportunity to learn other things, other ways.
Eva and Iris meet some wonderful characters in Hollywood, including their landlady, Mrs. Gruber, and Francisco Diego, a Mexican makeup artist. And more than one reviewer suggested that each of your characters is interesting enough to be the protagonist of a novel of his own.
I hope so. I mean, for me, there are no minor characters. For me, all of these people are full and alive, and we may only encounter them for a little while, but they are all deserving their own story.
Weren't you once a practicing psychotherapist? Are these characters based at all on people you've known, or are they just entirely invented?
They are, in fact, entirely invented. That's not to say that, you know, Edgar doesn't have my father's love of self-improvement and information-seeking, and it's not to say that Eva doesn't have my dislike of higher education, but they are all made-up people.
My guest is Amy Bloom, whose latest book is a novel called Lucky Us. Just as Iris starts to work in Hollywood, she falls in love with Rose, an actress she meets at a party. Didn't your inspiration for Iris come from a biography you'd read about Eva LaGallion, the openly lesbian actress who was also a producer and a director and famous during the first half of the 20th century? And I guess still there was an Eva LaGallion theater, wasn't there?
There was. I mean, she was amazing. And I read a terrific biography of her and was just sort of very struck by the force of her personality and her commitment to the theater. And she really was one of the creators of, you know, the entire idea of an American repertory theater. And she'd also been burned in a terrible fire at her country home and had to sort of teach herself all about how to use lighting, how to use makeup so that she could go on with her stage performing. And I liked her. I did get the feeling in her biography that there was a certain ruthlessness to her as well as a lot of charm, and I certainly gave that to Iris.
But she was openly gay, which I assume was rather unusual at the time, whether you were male or female.
It was unusual. I mean, in the same way that you are not going to see any major Hollywood romantic leads coming out in the next week or two. I mean, it was always a difficult thing, and what people did was, in their beautiful Hollywood homes especially, and the ladies had what they called sewing circles, which were not at all like sewing circles that anybody else had encountered, and they had fabulous, posh, decadent parties.
We won't go into any more detail. But although Eva LaGallion may have been the inspiration for Iris, you gave a different character, your narrator, her half-sister, who isn't gay, the name Eva.
I just liked the name Eva, and it was very clear to me who was Eva and who was Iris, regardless of what the source of Iris's personality was in the beginning of the book. You know, and the book moves forward in the sense, I mean, when you're writing it. So, you know, where you wind up with the flower is very different from where you start with the root.
And they wind up in very different places. I don't want to give too much away, but not long after Iris falls in love, she needs to leave town.
Yeah.
And they wind up first in Brooklyn, which Eva says is like Mars. Now, that was even before Bedford Avenue became a magnet for Martians?
I think it is like Mars to her because she has never been in a city of such density and so many different kinds of people going about their lives.
And they wind up in Great Neck, Long Island. Why there?
I grew up in Great Neck. I wish there was another better answer. Oh, it was the perfect place. And I think it was the perfect place. But it was a town that I was familiar with. And the history of Great Neck was very interesting to me.
And then they wind up working for the Torellis. And Iris falls desperately in love again, this time with Renee, the Torelli's cook. But Renee is already married to Gus Heitmann, a man of German descent. And this is taking place during World War II, so the plot thickens.
The plot, she does thicken. And Gus, for me, was a wonderful opportunity. First of all, I love Gus. I love the character. I have to say there are moments when I feel about Gus exactly as Eva did, which was that he was the kind of man who would go into a burning building to pull you out and go back in to get your poodle. And Gus gives me an opportunity to write about the internment of Germans in America during World War II.
He was an American citizen, but he ends up being sent to an internment camp under the enemy alien control program and then repatriated to Germany. Was that something that happened often?
Well, it didn't happen often, but it certainly happened often enough to have a dramatic impact on the lives and deaths of those Germans who did go back to Germany. These were often people who didn't speak German.
He'd lived here all of his life.
You know, he actually came to this country when he's a little baby, but doesn't speak any German, has no association to Germany. And it was the first time during that period that the phrase self-deportation was used.
Do you have any idea of how many Germans living in the U.S. were sent to internment camps during the war?
11,000.
So a lot less than Japanese Americans.
A lot less than Japanese, but we kept them longer. Truman felt that it would be very easy for Germans to fade back into the general Caucasian population, and so he made a decision that the Germans would not be released until well after the end of the war, and the last German was released in 1947.
And it was assumed that somebody like Gus, well, who you've invented, obviously, but still, someone like Gus would have been a Nazi sympathizer?
He might have been a Nazi sympathizer. We had a lot of trouble getting these things right. We also interned a number of German Jewish refugees who were escaping the Nazis.
Simply because they only spoke German.
Because they were German, and we got confused.
You've used popular song titles for many of the chapter headings. Do they inform what follows in the chapter?
I hope that they do. I mean, my intention with the song titles was that if you knew the song, you could hear a little melody as you read the words. And if you didn't know the song, the lyrics are so great and the lines themselves are so evocative that you could still use it as a portal to the chapter.
As I said earlier, you pile on one surprise after another. Are these surprises for you as well?
Sometimes. Mostly it's my
intention. Do you know where you're going?
I usually have an idea of where I'm going, but you know, even if you know you're turning right, you don't know exactly what you're going to come upon. And the characters, as they develop and as I'm writing scenes with them, I can see how that will lead to another scene. I had not originally, for example, conceived of the Torellis as they turned out to be, you know, sort of good-hearted, self-involved people who had just recently come into a lot of money. And as they became clearer, that created more opportunities in the story.
The title Lucky Us, are these people lucky?
Well, you know, there's more than one kind of luck is how I feel about it. I feel that it is great when the dice roll your way, but it's important to recognize that the dice are going to keep rolling, and sometimes it's going to go your way and sometimes it's not.
Lucky Us is published by Random House. My great thanks to Amy Bloom for being a guest on our show again.
My pleasure to be here.